Given the current election cycle and the need to reflect upon American democracy, I thought it would be interesting to hear about Unitarian presidents this morning on the weekend of the President's Day holiday. I wrestled with the structure for this sermon because of where I wish to place the emphasis of my message as delivered through portraits of the four United States presidents who were identified as UUs. Actually, these men were Unitarians, Unitarianism being the choice of educated social and economic elites, especially in New England. I decided, because of the biographical nature of what I'll share, to paint a picture of each of these leaders and their presidencies chronologically, the easier to follow who's who. The four presidents in our country's history who identified as Unitarians are John Adams, his son, John Quincy Adams, Millard Fillmore, and William Howard Taft. So there you have them. They'll stay up there behind me during the sermon. A note about Thomas Jefferson, John Adams' successor and worst friend, as we learned in the story this morning about their feud and lifelong friendship. Jefferson is often claimed as one of us, mostly because of his 1820 Jefferson Bible, which deleted the miracles of Jesus and told the life and morals of Jesus of Nazareth extracted. However, Jefferson identified as a Christian deist, not a Unitarian, although he occasionally attended Unitarian church services when they were more convenient to him than other houses of worship. This was not an unusual practice among leaders in the 19th century. Jefferson was an American humanist, as the subtitle of my grandfather's book indicates, but Jefferson's humanism was that of the Italian Renaissance, a 13th and 14th century system of education and mode of inquiry that originated in northern Italy and later spread through continental Europe and England. Jefferson has certainly been an influence on UUs throughout our history. So let me begin with John Adams, who lived from 1735 until, as his contemporary Jefferson did, July 4th, 1826. John Adams' father was born on a farm in Braintree, Massachusetts. His father was a church deacon who hoped his son would enter the ministry. John preferred farming. But once he was enrolled in a decent school, he began to excel in scholarship and love learning at Harvard. Adams had a lifelong relationship with First Parish Braintree, now Quincy. The minister there resisted labels on his Arminian theology, a precursor to Unitarianism, which upholds the role of free will in heeding the call to salvation. Adams' extended family was on both sides of the debate over Calvinistic doctrines of original sin, election, and salvation by arbitrary grace. Witnessing a spirit of dogmatism and bigotry in clergy and laity, Adams decided against going into the ministry. Instead, at age 20, Adams took a teaching post in Worcester. A few decades later, Worcester's second parish would be founded as a Unitarian congregation. To avoid being perceived as an Arminian, Adams decided to study law rather than ministry. He returned to Braintree to practice law, and when his father died and he inherited the family farm, he became qualified for citizenship in the Massachusetts colony. At 29, Adams married Abigail Smith, the Weymouth minister's daughter. They had 5 children, 2 daughters and 3 sons. Abigail was as widely read and as politically astute as her husband. Their hundreds of letters show she was her husband's full political partner and confidant throughout their marriage, according to Wesley Hromatko. Adams' legal career developed, and he got involved in the political issues of the day, taxation of American colonies by the British Crown to pay for the French and Indian War, for example. Adams was equally opposed to mob rule, and he successfully defended British soldiers involved in the 1770 Boston Massacre. At this time, Adams was appointed to general court and was selected as a representative to the First Continental Congress. Credited with proposing the Declaration of Independence, Adams was also recommended that the Virginian, Thomas Jefferson, be appointed to write the draft. Although Adams was a lifelong opponent of slavery, he did not protest when Congress cut Jefferson's condemnation of the economic practice from the document. I wonder how Jefferson, who owned slaves, addressed his own contradictions on this matter. On the matter of including women in the Declaration of Independence, Abigail, an early women's rights advocate, urged him to remember the ladies, but he dismissed this notion. Adams was the principal author of the Massachusetts Commonwealth Constitution, and most southern and mid-Atlantic states followed the structure he proposed. Following a decade of diplomatic service abroad, Adams came back home to Braintree, intending to retire from public life. Instead, for the next 9 years, he served as vice president to George Washington. When Washington retired, Adams ran as a Federalist against Jefferson, his one-time friend and now political opponent. Jefferson became vice president under Adams, and you heard about their various disagreements in the story. These 4 years were dominated by war with former ally, the French, and the passage of the Alien and Sedition Acts, which increased the residency requirement for citizenship and gave authority to expel dangerous foreigners to the president, which powers Adams never used. Jefferson ran against Adams in 1800, beating him due to Adams' unpopular war measures. It wasn't until 1812 that Adams and Jefferson reconciled with the help of Universalist physician, social reformer, and educator Benjamin Rush. According to Wesley Matko, Adams always preferred Unitarian worship services. He also expressed Universalist sympathies, a naturalistic faith, and a tolerant religious spirit. Like Washington, Jefferson, and other early political leaders, Adams could not always find a satisfactory congregational church and tried others, though he apparently avoided a congregation founded in Philadelphia by the Universalist Joseph Priestley's admirers. Adams and Jefferson held similar beliefs about human mortality and morality. John Adams lived to see his son inaugurated as the 6th president of the United States in 1825, but died a year later, several hours after Jefferson, on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Raised in the Unitarian household of his parents, John Quincy Adams, who lived from 1767 to 1848, was greatly influenced by both. As Charles Howe writes, at home, issues of government, politics, world affairs, literature, religion, and morality were all considered immediate and pressing. Graduating from Harvard in 1787, John Quincy tried his hand at law, but didn't find it fulfilling. Instead, he began developing a reputation as an orator and a newspaper essayist. Then, in 1794, President George Washington steered John Quincy into a diplomatic career, which included serving in Prussia during his father's presidency. John Quincy's political career started with election to the state Senate, followed by election to the U.S. Senate. As an independently minded Federalist senator, he supported some popular Republican measures, like the Louisiana Purchase, and other times stood alone against others, thus alienating himself from both parties. Concurrently, he taught rhetoric and oratory at Harvard. JQA, as he referred to himself, returned to diplomatic service under Presidents James Madison and later in the cabinet of President James Monroe. John Quincy Adams ran reluctantly with no official party affiliation against Democrat Andrew Jackson and Whig Henry Clay in 1824. This three-way race had to be decided by the House of Representatives, during which Clay backed JQA. Charles Howe characterizes John Quincy Adams' term as the nation's sixth president as a miserable and unproductive 4 years in office, 1825 to 1829, trying to work with an uncooperative Congress and continually under attack by Jackson and his other opponents as he attempted unsuccessfully to establish a national economic program. Sounds familiar. He was succeeded by Jackson. After a brief respite, JQA returned to the U.S. Congress as a representative from Massachusetts, serving until his death in 1848. He was intent on restoring his reputation and seeking revenge on his enemies. JQA successfully defended the rights of African captives who, in 1839, overwhelmed the crew of the Spanish slave ship Amistad. He opposed the Mexican War and statehood for Texas, as well as the gag rule denying the right of petition on issues involving slavery. Though not successful during his lifetime, his unwavering efforts against slavery had a powerful effect that outlived him. John Quincy was religiously more conservative than his parents. However, John Quincy's religious thinking, like his political thinking, appears to have been continuously evolving. Politically, he moved from a Federalist to a near Republican position. Religiously, he moved from a near Calvinist to a Unitarian position. Initially in Washington, D.C., there were no independent congregational churches where he would feel comfortable, but in 1821, JQA joined 27 others in founding the First Unitarian Church of Washington, though he often attended a second worship service of a different denomination on Sundays. Evidencing liberal leanings in his thinking generally, JQA was a dedicated seeker after religious truth. He was often critical of what he heard or read of the emerging Unitarian denomination. Down through the generations, the Adams family chronicled their religious journeys extensively, ultimately developed a cosmopolitan Christianity that blended discovery and criticism, faith and doubt. In her book, Household Gods, The Religious Lives of the Adams Family, Sarah Giorgini demonstrates how pivotal Christianity, as the different generations understood it, was shaping the family's decisions, great and small. Reflecting on his past, President John Adams mused it was religion that had shaped his family's fortune and young America's future. For the 19th century's first family, the Adams of Massachusetts, the history of how they lived religion was dynamic and well documented. Christianity supplied the language that Abigail used to interpret her husband John's political setbacks. Scripture armed their son John Quincy to act as father, statesman, and anti-slavery advocate. Unitarianism gave Abigail's Victorian grandson, Charles Francis, the religious confidence to persevere in political battles on the Civil War home front. By contrast, his son Henry found religion hollow and repellent compared to the purity of modern science. A renewal of faith led Abigail's great-grandson, Brooks, a Gilded Age critic of capitalism, to prophesy two world wars. The influence of John Adams' Unitarian beliefs can be seen in the seminal documents of the founding of our country. His son, John Quincy, carried on that tradition during his own political career. Unitarian beliefs are among those enshrined in our democracy. When John Quincy Adams died in February 1848, the American political scene was experiencing tensions brought about by the war with Mexico and threats from southern states who wished to extend slavery westward into the newly acquired territories. At this time, Millard Fillmore began serving as vice president under President Zachary Taylor, the winning general in the Mexican War, and a Whig. When Taylor suddenly died 2 years later, Fillmore succeeded to the presidency, becoming our 13th president. Fillmore's origin story is rather different than the Adams family. He was born in 1800 in the Finger Lakes region of West Central New York, the second of nine children in a transplanted New England farm family. They were poor, and at 15 years of age, Millard was apprenticed in the textile manufacturing industry, working there during summers and autumns, going to school in the winters, and helping the family farm in the springs. At 19, Millard began studying law and working as a teacher. At 23, Fillmore was admitted to the Erie County Bar and set up his practice in Aurora, not far from Buffalo. He married his sweetheart, Abigail, and they had two children. Fillmore's legal practice shifted to Buffalo when he became an attorney of the state's Supreme Court. Politics came next when Fillmore, as a member of the anti-Masonic party, worked with the National Republicans for the 1828 renomination of John Quincy Adams. As a member of the New York State Assembly, Fillmore drafted and secured the passage of a law abolishing imprisonment for debt in New York. He opposed a bill that required witnesses to swear their belief in God and the afterlife, which never emerged from committee. Walter Hertz writes, Fillmore had liberal ideas about religion. He had been raised by nominal Methodists, studied under a Quaker judge, and may have attended or visited a short-lived Unitarian society in Kelloggsville. In late 1831, a Unitarian church was organized near Fillmore's home in Buffalo. Millard became a charter member. Abigail, who had been brought up Baptist, did not actively participate. Fillmore's association with First Unitarian Church of Buffalo lasted for 35 years. He took John Quincy Adams to church with him there in 1843, and President-elect Abraham Lincoln in 1861. For unknown and puzzling reasons, he turned down an 1849 invitation to speak at a Unitarian meeting in Boston, saying, "I sympathize with those who enhance liberal Christianity, but I am not a member of the Unitarian Church." He was, however, a financial supporter of one. This is a lead up to next month, if you didn't quite catch that. Reading Paul Finkelman's Millard Fillmore, part of the Times book's The American Presidents series, Fillmore appears to be a rather enigmatic figure. His actions as a politician seem to be in direct conflict with statements made by him, as well as the prevailing opinion of Unitarian contemporaries. Filling out Taylor's presidential term from 1850 to 1853, the author describes Fillmore thus. Born in poverty, poorly educated, and utterly unsophisticated, Millard Fillmore is one of our most obscure presidents and one of our worst. In 1848, this virtually unknown former congressman from Buffalo, New York, was elected vice president. And when Zachary Taylor died, he became America's second accidental president. He took office at a crossroads in America's history, and his failure set the stage for the larger failure of politics that led to the Civil War. Fillmore pushed through the Compromise of 1850, obsessively enforced the Fugitive Slave Act, and was rejected by his own party, the Whigs, when he sought a full term of his own. Hostile to foreigners, non-Protestants, and abolitionists, he received his only presidential nomination in 1856 from the anti-Catholic Know Nothing Party. He opposed Abraham Lincoln and was pro-slavery to the end. His neighbors in Buffalo considered him a traitor in the Civil War. A Unitarian. My impression of Fillmore is that he was possibly conflict avoidant and therefore unable to hold to values in public that he held privately. Finkelman admits that Millard Fillmore's legacy includes some visionary ideas that he could not accomplish, pushing for a transcontinental railroad, opening Japan to American diplomacy and trade, maintaining a dominant American presence in Hawaii, and pushing for a Central American canal. But on the central issues of the age, his vision was myopic and his legacy was worse. I can't help but wonder how Finkelman would compare the 45th president to the 13th. Despite this underwhelming legacy, Fillmore became a respected leading citizen of Buffalo as a result of his civic contributions during the two decades after his accidental presidential term. And let me just insert here that there are other Unitarians who served in our government at the level of vice president and senators and so on and so forth, who also have less than desirable legacies. We turn last but not least to William Howard Taft, who served as our nation's 27th president from 1909 to 1913. Taft, who lived from 1857 to 1930, was raised by active Unitarian parents in Cincinnati, Ohio. It appears that of Taft's siblings and his own children, he is the only one who remained affiliated with the Unitarian faith tradition. Taft was not shy about sharing the good news of Unitarianism at home and abroad, including during his administrative years in the Philippines. Like two of our other three Unitarian-identified presidents, Taft became a lawyer. He served in various judgeships, civilian commissions, and posts overseas. Taft's ultimate ambition was to serve as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But his wife, Nellie, played the hand for his presidential nomination by Theodore Roosevelt. During the election campaign, Taft was attacked viciously for being Unitarian, actually being accused of being an infidel and a Catholic, among other monikers. And if you know our history with Catholicism, these tactics actually backfired, convincing urban Catholics to vote for the Republican ticket and electing Taft. And just remember, Republicans were then what Democrats are today and vice versa, which I have to keep, you know, fiddling around with in my mind. It wasn't a happy presidential term. Congress didn't work well with him. Fortunately, Taft had his deep and abiding Unitarian faith as solace. He attended All Souls Church regularly, got more involved in Unitarian organizations, and once he was out of office, became actively involved in denominational affairs. There is life after the presidency. Taft supported the war policies of his successor, Woodrow Wilson, and spoke in favor of the League of Nations. He introduced a pro-war resolution at the 1917 National Conference of the American Unitarian Association. The unfortunate result was that many pacifist ministers were eventually dismissed by Unitarian churches throughout the country, including that of his original home congregation in Cincinnati. In 1921, President Warren G. Harding fulfilled Taft's major ambition by appointing him Chief Justice of the United States. He is the only person to have served both as President of the United States and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He remains the only Unitarian Chief Justice. Now, having given you some sense of those U.S. presidents who were Unitarians during the nearly 250 years of our nation's history, the primary take-home message I wish to leave you with is twofold. First, Unitarian Universalists are not monolithic in our beliefs. How we live out our faith and the real impact or legacy that our lives may have on others. Over the course of history, we have been on the positive and the negative sides, both, as well as everything in between, of the arc of the universe in its trajectory towards the ideals of peace, liberty, and justice for all living beings. Second, It is part of our UU heritage to be actively involved in civic and political life, serving the common good to the best of our abilities. I know that there are a number of you here who have and are serving in public roles, as well as the many of you who make your voice and the voices of others heard at the local, state, and national levels. Keep doing that. Let us do what we can to repair, heal, and nurture the democratic ideals we espouse as a faith tradition and as a country founded on those ideals.